Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. For thousands of years, patriarchal cultures have created elaborate dualistic symbol systems based on gender. Men are associated with the sun, day, and action, women with the moon, night, and wisdom. Men associated themselves with tools and culture, and women with fertility and nature. The first wave of 60s feminists rejected these dualisms and attempted to reclaim the masculine for themselves. Women mechanics, scientists, athletes, and politicians all plunged into fields formerly considered for men only. People were seen as essentially androgynous, and gendered identities and aspirations were merely the result of patriarchal brainwashing, which it was our duty to throw off. Then a second wave of 70s and 80s feminism began to re-embrace a concept of essential differences between the genders. In its eco-feminist variant, women were in fact seen as more in touch with nature, and patriarchy was the root cause of humanity's destruction of nature. The struggle for empowerment of women was thus essential for the protection of nature, and in the process society would have to give up a host of industries, practices, and machines. Then in 1985, socialist feminist theoretician Donna Haraway published Manifesto for Cyborgs, Science, Technology, and Socialist Feminism in the 1980s in the journal Socialist Review. The essay was a broadside against feminist essentialism and a radical restatement of the importance of androgyny. Haraway proposed that the cyborg was the perfect mythic image for the modern revolutionary woman, embracing her incorporation of masculine and feminine, organic human, and machine. Haraway says that by being cyborgs rather than goddesses, feminists can break and reshape the old dualisms in empowering ways. Haraway's essay and subsequent writings have inspired a whole field of cyborgologists looking at media images of cyborgs and gender discourses around women and machines. One theorist whose work has moved the field forward is Anne Balsamo. Dr. Balsamo is a former professor now working at Xerox PARC Labs in Palo Alto on research in experimental documents. In her book, Technologies of the Gendered Body, Reading Cyborg Women, she discusses bodybuilding, reproductive technology, plastic surgery, virtual reality, and communications networks as instances where technology impacts or escapes from the body. Anne, in your essay, Reading Cyborgs, Writing Feminism, which is included in the volume, The Gendered Cyborg, you say that Haraway's attempt to hold up cyborgs as a utopian archetype is misguided. While at the same time, you agree that cyborgs and women have a lot in common, do you still agree that it's empowering for women to see themselves as androgynous, transgressive human machines, or are you simply saying that the cyborg is empty of political content until we give it some?
Well, my original critique of Haraway's appropriation of the cyborg was a very kind of historically specific critique. When Haraway's essay came out in 1986, the images of the cyborg that were available kind of in popular culture and so on were actually pretty frightening images. They were images of male bodies, men who had been technologically enhanced or technologically augmented, and were for the most part just, you know, very intense killing machines. So that cyborgian kind of figure at that moment in time, in that kind of, in our popular imagination, I don't think was as liberatory as she wanted it to be. It was in fact the unholy union of two very oppressive forces, men and the kind of masculine male body, very macho, very muscular, and so on, with kind of technologies that were destructive. So
the Terminator movie came out. Yeah, it came out the year before her essay.
Exactly. You know, and then right on the heels of that was RoboCop, and you know, we didn't have in our kind of popular kind of pantheon, we just didn't have very many images of alternative configurations of the cyborg. And I thought that her manifesto was provocative, and I think it was addressed to technophobic feminists who were trying to argue that we should turn our back on technology because you know, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. And with all due respect to Audre Lorde, that was exactly, the kind of feminist position that I think Haraway was trying to contest. And the problem is that she put in place this notion of the cyborg, and, you know, I know several of my feminist colleagues, when they first read it, they're like, I don't want to be a cyborg. And they didn't want to be a cyborg because at that moment it implied, you know, a kind of hyper kind of killing machine or hyper destructive machine or somebody who is so masculinist in their kind of form or their, you know, kind of intent that it didn't play well with, you know, with the women that were, that kind of were the intended audiences for her essay. So the critique was, you know, we need to really rethink this cyborg figure as an animating kind of figure for our imagination, because it's just not there. It's not ready right yet for us to kind of inhabit it. And I think what I tried to do was kind of in my book was to show that there were many ways in which we were already cyborgs. We were always already cyborgs. You know, that whether it's women using bodybuilding technology or, you know, getting tattooed or, you know, making their body meaningful through, you know, the application of technology or surgery, you know, or women who use reproductive technologies, that we were already kind of women kind of in general, or women as a kind of as a class, we were already deeply engaged with technology, and sometimes those engagements were at our own kind of at our own volition, and other times those engagements were not at our own volition, meaning that we were cast as kind of subjects of technology, even if we wanted to turn our back on them or so on. And that was, you know, definitely true of women who are in the U.S. and, you know, of a particular, you know, educational kind of class and so on. But even women who are not of a particular educational class get, you know, get kind of cast as subjects of technology. And the subject, the technology that might be, you know, used on them or that are kind of influencing them are, you know, technologies of surveillance, of discipline, you know, technologies that somehow kind of infiltrate their bodily kind of existence, whether overtly or, you know, through chemicals or, you know, covertly in terms of, you know, just watching women's bodies on, you know, on video. Yeah, or through databases and stuff. Mm-hmm. So in part, what I was trying to suggest was, you know, it may not be a choice for us to kind of take up the image of the cyborg as a way to think through the notion of woman in a post-industrial age. That, you know, we may, you know, even though there may be kind of the popular cultural images may be frightening and not what we want, that in fact we are already being treated as technological subjects with, you know, as having bodies that are technologically permeable.
So your position is more, we are cyborgs, but we're not exactly happy about it.
Yeah, I guess in a nutshell that we are, you know, we are already kind of cyborgs. We're kind of embedded in these cybernetic networks. We are cast, you know, either volitionally or not as, you know, as agents of technology. And I think that there are uneven consequences of that. That for some it may be entirely liberatory, and for others it could be a prison.
For about 5 or 6 years, we had a picture of Linda Hamilton from Terminator 2 tacked up on our fridge, and my wife and I both considered her holding that submachine gun with her big muscles bulging out as the image of the, you know, well-rounded revolutionary woman of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And but you, in your book, were very critical of women's bodybuilding for eroticizing women's the same bodybuilding the women were doing was eroticized when it was not eroticized for men, which I'm not sure is entirely true, because there may be a kind of a repressed homoerotic aspect to male bodybuilding, but leave that aside. But don't you think it's a kind of a cup half full, cup half empty kind of thing? Because isn't it better that we have buffed out Linda Hamilton as a hero than some wimpy female from the past?
When women who use bodybuilding technology are looked at and are represented, one of the ways in which the powerful kind of the power implied by a strong body, female body, or a strong body that now is augmented by technology, the way in which that power is nullified is through a kind of eroticization. So I think my point was not that it wasn't empowering for those who engage it as agents, but rather when culture, popular culture, or those who represent and are kind of looking at women who are cyborgian, that in very subtle ways that enormous power gets nullified. And it might be in the way of, you know, eroticizing them, so reminding us that they are sexual creatures, and sexual creatures, we can't just like be powerfully, you know, kind of fully buffed women without somehow having that, being reminded also that, we are beholden somehow to a, you know, to a higher logic of reproduction, logic of, procreation.
I'm speaking with Anne Balsamo. She's the research scientist in residence at Xerox PARC, focusing on humanistic applications of technology, and author of many essays and a book on cybergology from a feminist perspective. Yesterday, President Bush made a kind of waffly decision about stem cells, and in doing so, he's appointed this medieval medical ethicist, Leon Cass, who's an outspoken anti-feminist and an outspoken bio-Luddite, as his chief advisor on these topics. I'm very sympathetic with Laurie Andrews' position that libertarian feminist position that feminists should embrace the notion of radical bodily autonomy as liberating both for women and for everybody. That instead of getting on the bandwagon of anti-reproductive technology folks who are almost all coming out of the right to life camp at this point. Where do you see that coming together, that issue, that feminist technology issue for folks? Because most of the feminist criticism of reproductive technology that I read remains bio-Luddite.
Well, I'm sympathetic to that position. Laurie Andrews, right. Also, I mean, I too believe that at the base we should fight for bodily autonomy. It's interesting, though, even as I say that, I've wrestled with this contradiction that is kind of that comes to the fore when you argue that, because that's the kind of foundation of a kind of philosophical position of individualism, of radical individualism, and, you know, to kind of harken back to, you know, the Cyborg Manifesto, one of the issues, or one of the themes that, you know, that Haraway was, you know, was kind of animating, was a critique of this radical individualism. You know, the notion of the cyborg is a cybernetic organism. You know, her point was that we are, you know, I mean, separate from kind of the cyborg as a kind of embodied creature, as creatures who are embedded in cybernetic networks. You know, her argument was we are not radical individuals, that everything I do with my body, in terms of my consumption, in terms of how heavy I trod on the land, and so on, everything I do has consequences for other people and other beings and other species and, you know, and the world that we live in. And so there is this, you know, this kind of fundamental contradiction that is kind of rearing its head for us right now between wanting to hold on to and really fight for the right of women and men to determine their own kind of bodily status and their bodily experience, and to own the material of their body, their genetic material, their, you know, the information produced upon, you know, based on their body and so on. At the same time, we also, you know, have to understand the way in which we are not individuals in the, you know, in a cybernetic sense, that, you know, it's an illusion to think I stop at my skin when, you know, the waste I produce is going to affect generations to come. You know, bodies I haven't even met yet, and bodies that haven't even been born yet are going to be affected by, you know, by my bodily practices. And, you know, that's one of those kind of conceptual impasses that I don't know can be worked out in theory, and probably can only be kind of untangled or kind of hacked through in practice.
Speaking with Dr. Anne Balsamo, she's a feminist culture critic and a research scientist at Xerox PARC. You've moved on now from being a culture critic to being an applied media researcher. How did that come about?
I got to the end of my book, and started kind of reflecting on a couple things, which was, you know, there was a trajectory to the chapters in the book that pretty much marked the way my research had developed. So from moving from a kind of very literal kind of instantiation of the body technology kind of dyad, so female bodybuilders, moving from that to a very metaphoric or elusive kind of manifestation, which is the body in connection with other bodies mediated through communication technologies. And I realized that what I was kind of migrating toward in terms of my own thinking was an understanding that it was going to be these media technologies that were probably kind of the most potent reproductive technologies kind of our age, that even more so than biological reproductive technologies that were still at that point still very experimental and even now are still kind of out of the realm of the daily experience of most people, that media technologies are, you know, are implicated every day in each of our reproductive kind of processes. You know, just as I, you know, my identity is something that gets reproduced every day through my, you know, habits of consumption and so on, they are also, my identity is also kind of a product of my engagement with the media. So I became more and more interested in the development of media applications, of digital media, of what was getting circulated in these new media channels or through these new media channels, you know, so whether it was images of, you know, of women in video games or, you know, the invocation or disavowal of gender kind of in discussions about virtual reality or online communication or so on, I thought that I wanted to pay attention to, you know, to the whole realm of new media technologies. And I also started thinking that perhaps what I needed to be doing was thinking about how new media is actually produced, how it's invented, how it's innovated, and then rather than continue to stand outside as a critic of the products that circulate and make up our media landscape, that perhaps it was time for me to really take serious the question, how would I do it differently now that I have all this kind of critical ammunition about how bad, you know, our media landscape is in terms of its liberatory potential or its representation of women or its, you know, its empowering capabilities. Now that I know that it doesn't work, maybe I should turn my attention to really wrestling with how to make it better or how to do it differently.
When I was in grad school, I was told that I'd be a very boring sociologist if I went around finding replications of Durkheim or Weber's typologies everywhere I looked, that would not impress anybody with my analytical skills. Was that the same kind of thing?
Absolutely. Did we really need Anne Balsamo's one more analysis of, you know, a failed advertising campaign that reinscribes, you know, the dualistic patriarchal logic of gender. My take on this is that I ended up feeling like a forensics pathologist, like I was always coming onto the scene of the crime after the crime had been committed.
Yet another bullet wound.
Yes, you know, oh, here we go again. And instead, not that I wanted to be the perpetrators of the crime, but I thought, well, maybe I could be a superhero that kind of comes onto the scene of the crime before the crime is committed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and intervenes before any evil is done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that animating fantasy, you know, took shape in different ways. The book came out and I got tenure very soon after, you know, I had the opportunity to reflect on what was I going to do next in this post-tenure kind of moment of euphoria. And what I wanted to do was start building multimedia applications and to really wrestle with this notion of what would be a feminist multimedia kind of application. And I took inspiration from Pat Cadigan's novel Sinners, where she has, kind of as her central figure, this notion of a sinner, S-Y-N-N-E-R-S. A sinner is a human synthesizer. It's a human being who uses technology in very creative ways. And I thought, man, that's a very empowering image for me as a woman and as a feminist, to imagine that I could use these technologies to tell my story. And whether it's to tell my critical story or to tell women's stories or to tell my biographical story, that I could use these technologies. I could synthesize, you know, stories and technologies and put in place and put in circulation the kind of stuff I wasn't seeing as part of our kind of media landscape. So one of the early things that I and one of my feminist colleagues in Atlanta did was we created a feminist multimedia documentary that we took to the 1995 UN Conference on Women, and we registered as an NGO forum or an NGO. We took a delegation of female engineering students from Georgia Tech, and we showed this multimedia documentary at the NGO forum. It was called Women of the World Talk Back, and it was from beginning to end conceptualized as a piece of feminist multimedia. It was built on a very different kind of communications model. It used and was informed by kind of the history of feminist aesthetics, feminist kind of analysis of cross-cultural stories, cross-cultural voices. And it really got me hooked on the possibilities of really kind of getting in and developing and designing new media. From there, I worked on a webcast and of the Olympics in Atlanta, and got to kind of work out some insights and some experiences doing new media journalism, which again was kind of an attempt to how could you use these technologies to to tell different stories in a more journalistic sense. And it was after that that I met up with somebody from Xerox PARC, who now is actually my manager at PARC, and we hit it off right away, and we hit it off because we were both kind of approaching kind of the issue of technology from a humanistic perspective. And our focus and our kind of point of resonance was that the people who are doing technology development really need to kind of take humanistic concerns into account while they're designing. It doesn't do any good to beat these technologists and these technological innovators over the head after they've done something, after they put a product out or after they put an application out, because they've got so much invested in their innovations and their inventions that all they're going to do is get defensive and close down and stop listening. That in fact, the critique that needs to happen to get things designed differently has to happen in the process of the design, not after the fact, because the people who are designing are human beings, and they get defensive. So he, we really hit it off, and we have a similar kind of interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary kind of sensibility. And it was actually 2 years after I met him, his name is Rich Gold, that he called and said that he had a headcount opening in his group at Xerox PARC. He was starting to kind of get this group moving towards a new project, and he invited me to come out and interview for a position. And I did, and I decided to make the shift from academia to industry because I realized that there would be no richer opportunity for me to really get into the details and into the kind of the practices of how technology gets developed, innovated, and designed than to be a researcher at Xerox PARC.
Your current project is on the future of reading?
The experiments in the future of reading was originally designed for the San Jose Tech Museum. It includes 12 interactive reading devices of the future, none of which are handheld e-books, not because we don't think those are going to be reading devices of the future. It's because that's the only thing people think we're going to read on in the future. Our reading devices include a tabletop interface that called the Tilty Table. You surf through large documents, room-sized documents, by tilting your tabletop, working off of the notion of what if your coffee table really was a book? What kind of social interactions would that engender? We developed a personal reading companion called the Reading Eye Dog, which is a kind of robot dog that reads whatever is put in front of its eyes, and then through text-to-speech synthesis, reads it out loud, imagining that as a companion device for people who have reading difficulties of various sorts. We have augmented paper books, paper-based books that are augmented digitally, that you read through the kind of typical hand gestures of turning pages and so on, but your hand gestures also activate a soundtrack for the book. I did the digital application for a reading wall, which contains 36 episodes in the history of reading, writing, and communication forms that goes from 25,000 BCE through the contemporary era. And the whole point of this was to speculate about how we might read in the future, to suggest the antecedents that will inform our reading devices, to say that we're not going to read perhaps any less paper-based things in the future. We may read many other things, but paper books will continue to exist. Typographic, text-based reading will continue to be an important skill and something that should ground our kind of efforts in literacy and new media literacy. But the point of the exhibition was to kind of help us imagine and to reaffirm kind of the importance of reading both now and in the future. It is now touring the U.S. It's installed in the Arizona Science Center in Phoenix. It will be there until the end of December, and then it'll go to 7 other science technology centers throughout the U.S. between now and the end of 2003. And my role there was to constantly kind of think about the cultural implications and the cultural theory of the pieces that we were building. Because when you talk about the notion of reading and writing, those are some of the base skills that we use to reproduce ourselves, you know, as kind of individuals and a sense of who we are, but also to reproduce ourselves as members of a community and social creatures. So I've kind of moved from biological reproduction and technological reproduction to looking at technologies of social and cultural reproduction. And reading is, you know, an ancient technology whereby, you know, individuals are reproduced as members of a culture, kind of getting back to kind of acknowledging how individuals are also members of that kind of cybernetic matrix that we call culture or we call society.
That's totally awesome. I wish I had more time to talk today, and I look forward to seeing more of your work. I've been speaking today with Dr. Ann Balsamo. She's a research scientist at Xerox PARC working on now the future of reading. What's your next project?
I have a book in process called Designing Culture, The Technological Imagination at Work, and it will contain chapters that address each of these new media projects and have some sort of digital component that will also kind of make these chapters kind of digitally available in different ways.
Cool. You can find Ann Balsamo's webpage by typing Ann Balsamo, B-A-L-S-A-M-O, into any search engine. And I wish you much luck with your future work.
Thank you. Thanks for the questions. Bye, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.